On this episode of Women Behind Bars, one woman pled guilty to a bloody killing spree in a local bar.
He put the gun right up to his face and told him to get down on the ground. When he refused to do it, he shot him in the face.
He had a dream about robbing the bar and us going to Oregon. So I was like, yeah.
Then Vanessa Crawley tells her story. She was an alleged accomplice in the senseless murder of a casual friend.
The fact that she didn't pull the trigger doesn't mean that she didn't lure Al Roberts to the car.
I didn't even want to go to sleep because every time I closed my eyes, all I could see was Al falling.
Two women, two brutal crimes. These are the stories of Denise Holsinger and Vanessa Crawley. The seaside metropolis of Virginia Beach enjoys a thriving tourist industry and a low crime rate. But on June 30th, 1994, just days before the July 4th crowds were due, a grisly crime rocked the beach community. Four people were found brutally slain inside a neighborhood tavern called the Witch Duck Inn.
It was almost like a slaughterhouse in there, and that was our first quadruple homicide that we experienced in the city.
Police arrived minutes after the massacre, but the killers were gone.
We knew that we had four people dead. We didn't have any witnesses to speak of.
This was a terribly violent dispatch of four lives. There was something personal in this killing.
The investigation led to a 29-year-old woman named Denise Holsinger, a former bartender who had recently been fired from the Witch Duck Inn.
I'm in shock. I didn't do anything.
The case would hinge on detectives' abilities to get her to talk and reveal who was responsible for the killings.
It was not my ideal to rob the bar.
Without a doubt, Denise Holsinger was the spider woman behind it.
In that interview room with Denise, there was a presence in there. There was almost a presence of evil.
Did Denise Holsinger just play a small part in a robbery gone wrong? Or did she orchestrate a ruthless mass murder? Denise Holsinger was born in a small town near Kansas City. Her parents separated when she was still a baby.
My father left when I was about a year old. I've never known my real father.
Denise spent much of her childhood with her grandparents, who helped fill the void left by her absent father.
My grandparents got me through a lot. We'd go fishing, and you know, my grandpa taught me how to bait my hook and my love of nature.
Denise's mother remarried twice, and two younger brothers were born. At 8 years old, Denise claims her second stepfather began molesting her.
I had a daytime dad who, you know, took us different places, you know, and played softball and stuff, and we'd go to the games, and then I had a nighttime dad who would come into my room. I feel my mother did the best that she could, but she just wasn't aware.
When Denise was 11, the family moved to Phoenix, Arizona. At 13, she started running away from home.
I was extremely rebellious as a teenager. Started doing drugs and drinking, hanging out with a rougher crowd.
Life on the streets forced Denise to make desperate choices.
Being a runaway, I had sex a lot to have some place to sleep or something to eat. I feel that the molest led me to be extremely promiscuous because that's all I thought that love was.
Denise lived at home off and on during her troubled teen years. But her rebellious streak kept her on the streets, doing drugs and hanging out with a bad crowd. She says she was raped three separate times.
The first two times I was raped, even the third time, it just felt like that's all I was good for. So it really didn't, at the time, it didn't emotionally faze me. I started gaining weight after the rape, the last rape.
Denise dropped out of high school and began exotic dancing to support herself. At 19 years old, she moved to Tennessee, where she met Randall Holsinger, who was in the Navy.
I was tired, and here was somebody who wanted to take care of me. He was everything that I had not ever had in my life. He was stable, he was clean cut.
Denise and Randall married in 1984, and the newlyweds moved to California, where Randall was stationed.
I loved him, but I don't think that I've ever actually been in love. I wanted to be a good wife.
1 year into the marriage, Denise gave birth to a baby girl.
I was 21 when I had my oldest daughter. I was so scared. I remember when she was little bitty, we had a cradle by the bed, and I would sleep with my hand on her because I just knew God was going to punish me and take my baby because of the person, the bad things I had done in my life.
I don't think she was ready to be a mother. I'm not sure if she ever would have been ready to be a mother.
I tried to be the best parent that I could. I didn't have good skills.
Denise continued to gain weight, which she says made her self-esteem plummet. 2 years later, in 1987, she gave birth to another daughter, and then a son in 1989.
As a mom, she was indifferent. She would sleep, and the kids would be up running around the house and whatever, and she'd just sleep.
My memories of her were chaotic and very far and few in between, and I had to walk myself to kindergarten.
Denise admits she was overwhelmed as a mother and struggled with alcohol and a prescription drug addiction that fueled terrible fights with her husband.
She definitely knew how to push my buttons. We'd start yelling at each other. There was a couple times she'd hit me, and, you know, so I just back off and say, okay, you know, I gotta go.
I was very, very self-destructive. We were separated many, many, many times. I wish things had been different. I wish I had been the person I am now then. I'd have pushed harder for us to have therapy.
In 1992, Randall was transferred to Virginia Beach, Virginia. Both Denise and her husband hoped this could be a fresh start for their family.
I thought by changing myself, I could help the relationship. You know, I was about 120 pounds overweight by then. He told me for years I was fat, dumb, and ugly, and nobody else would ever want me.
Well, when you get in an argument, you say things. I'd say things like that, and she would say things back at me. I mean, it's tit for tat.
Shortly after moving to Virginia Beach, Denise underwent surgery to have her stomach stapled.
When I had my stomach stapled and I started to lose weight, started going to bars, drinking, and other men wanted me, I went wild.
It seems like her personality changed a bit, and that she starts saying, oh, look at me, I'm so pretty, I lost all this weight, I'm so pretty, look at me.
Within months, Denise left her family and ran off to Tennessee with a new boyfriend. She stayed for almost a year.
I started drinking a lot and doing crystal meth. Because of years of listening to my husband, you know, that I was fat, dumb, and ugly, there was just something in me, a very warped, sick part that had to prove that it wasn't true for my own self-esteem.
In March 1994, 29-year-old Denise separated from her husband for the last time. She landed a job as a bartender and waitress at the Witch Duck Inn, owned by Lam Van Son. Lam was a Vietnamese immigrant who had come to the United States to live the American dream. He had just bought the Witch Duck Inn and had opened for business when he hired Denise.
He's a great husband, and he was a great friend. We helped each other closing down the restaurant.
Lam often brought his 5-year-old son to work with him.
Lam usually take Joshua to the restaurant. He loved to show off Joshua with the customer.
While working at the Witch Duck Inn, Denise met a frequent customer of the bar, 32-year-old Michael Claggett.
He was pretty much a drifter, a little bit of a boozer, somebody who was just a shade on the wrong side of the law, but nobody who would have raised any kind of terrible red flags.
My husband cook him food and sometimes bought him a pitcher of beer or something like that.
Claggett lavished Denise with the attention she craved. He lived in an apartment complex next to the tavern, and the two became romantically involved.
Michael had a charisma, and he was the little boy lost who needed me. I think we were obsessed with each other. The sex was good. We filled a void in each other.
Just 2 months into the job, Denise was caught stealing. She says it was to help Michael, who needed cash.
I started drinking on the job, dipping into the till because Michael didn't have any money.
The bar owner, Lam, had to let her go.
He fired her and allowed her to come back and be a customer. And he paid for it with his life.
When Women Behind Bars continues.
He approached each one of them and shot them in the back of the head.
This little boy was inside that bar when these four people were killed.
In In the summer of 1994, 29-year-old Denise Holsinger says she was living a self-destructive life that stemmed from low self-esteem and addiction to alcohol and prescription drugs. Separated from her husband and recently fired from her bartending job at the Witch Duck Inn, Denise went on a month-long partying binge with her boyfriend, 33-year-old petty criminal Michael Claggett. On June 30, 1994, Claggett's birthday, Denise and Michael spent the day drinking and doing drugs.
We went to several bars and drank and drank.
Around 11 p.m. that night at Claggett's apartment, Denise claims Michael suggested they rob the Witch Duck Inn.
He had a dream about robbing the bar and us going to Oregon. So I was like, yeah.
Michael had a .357 revolver that he had stolen from his roommate.
He told me to go up to the bar and see who was there.
Once they got to the front of the Witch Duck Inn, Denise Holsinger went in first. She came back out and told Michael that there was only four people in the bar that he could come in.
In the bar that night were the owner, Lam Van Son, a part-time cook, Wendell J.R. Parrish, a customer named Abdelaziz Gren, and the new bartender, Karen Rounds. Asleep in the back office was a fifth person, Lam's five-year-old boy, Joshua.
And I went back in, and I was sitting there drinking a beer, and the next thing I know, he jumped over the bar. He told me to lock the door. He told everybody to get on the floor. And everybody got on the floor but J.R.
All but one laid down on the floor. Wendell J.R. Parrish stayed in his seat at the bar.
He put the gun right up to his face and told him to get down on the ground. When he refused to do it, he shot him in the face.
It was all just a really big blur. I got the money out of the register. He told me to go out the back door. When I got to the office door, I heard the rest of the shots.
He had everybody down on the ground and approached each one of them and shot him in the back of the head.
Surprisingly, the five-year-old son of Lam had slept through the entire shooting.
This little boy was inside that bar when these four people were killed.
Joshua's still sleeping, which surprised me. Joshua's very, very light sleeper. Very. And all that gunshot, I don't know why he didn't wake up.
How he survived is still a question of great debate. Michael Claggett says Denise spotted him and said he's got to be killed too. And Michael Claggett said he couldn't do it.
She wanted that little boy killed. Couldn't do it.
Denise denies ever seeing the sleeping child as they fled out the back door.
We walked back to the apartment. Mike started throwing everything that he had, his clothes and stuff, in trash bags. He was like, we've got to get out of here. We've got to go. We've got to go.
They counted the money. They got away with $400, $100 a life.
While Denise and Michael skipped town and headed to North Carolina, customers showed up to the bar just minutes after the massacre.
The entire homicide unit was called out on it just because of the sheer scope of the case.
They couldn't have missed the killers by much. You know, when they walked in, Karen Rounds is on the ground with a mortal wound, but she's still alive, and so is Abdelaziz Gren. He's still alive.
Karen Rounds and Abdelaziz Gren were rushed to the emergency room. Both died shortly after.
When I got there, I said, where's my son? Where's Josh? And I saw Joshua was walking with one of my customers behind there walking. And I said, where's Lum? Lum's dead. And I remember I screamed so loud. I can even hear my voice right now in my head. And right at that time, I know that I just lost a best friend.
Inside the bar, investigators tried to piece together what happened.
It was probably one of the most grisly scenes I've seen as a homicide detective. We had Wendell Parrish, who was sitting at the bar, and his head was down on the bar. And it appeared that he had a single gunshot wound to the forehead. We had the owner of the business lying in the prone position on his stomach. He also had a single gunshot wound to the back of the head.
This was a terribly violent dispatch of four lives. So they believe there was something personal in this killing.
We knew that we had four people dead. We didn't have any witnesses to speak of.
The detectives believe if they don't have a suspect within 24 hours, they're starting to lose it. Within 48 hours, if they don't know where that crime is going, there's a high chance they'll never solve that crime.
While investigators combed the crime scene, Denise and Michael slept only a couple hours at a hotel, then returned to Virginia Beach.
I talked him into going back to the beach. I just wanted to go home.
By 6 a.m., they were back in Michael's apartment. The pair then joined the crowd of onlookers outside the Witch Duck Inn.
Criminals often do return to the scene of the crime, whether it be curiosity or what.
Both of them had come back to the scene to watch us process the crime scene.
Denise was very animated, was demanding answers as to what we were doing to find the people responsible. She wanted them caught, she wanted them punished. She was very animated in this, and she stuck out in my mind for that reason.
When police learned she had recently been fired from the bar, they realized it was time to take a closer look at Denise Holsinger. She was now at the top of their list of suspects. When Women Behind Bars continues,
Michael Claggett did not have the capacity to be a mastermind in this crime. Michael Claggett was led by Denise.
I didn't see him shoot anybody.
And later,
and that's when he took the gun out, pointed at my head and said, "This is the only way out our marriage, so don't F up."
On the night of June 30th, 1994, four people were slaughtered at a small tavern called the Witch Duck Inn. It was, at the time, the worst mass murder in Virginia Beach history. Police suspected that Denise Holsinger, a former employee of the bar, was somehow involved. Just 17 hours after the murders, Holsinger was brought in for questioning.
They took me to the station. Self-preservation kicked in, and I lied some more.
Everybody who sits down across the table from a detective thinks they're smarter than the police, and almost nobody is.
When I began talking with her, probably about a half an hour into the interview, Denise became very flirtatious with me, which was very strange, especially when I'm sitting in there and talking to her about four of her friends now that have been shot and killed in a bar.
I think he jumped over the bar.
He jumped over the bar.
I think he did.
What's he going
and all
after?
All of a sudden, he was like right there. And I thought it was like all just a joke. Remember?
Is everybody else going on the floor?
Everybody's going on the floor.
Okay.
And I looked at him and I said, "Mike, what the?"
I said, "Well, why would Michael kill these people in this bar?"
Trying to show you what a man he was or what? Is that what he said? He did, he shot these people because you're sexy.
She'd go back and forth. She'd be very angry, and then she'd try to be seductive toward them, and she'd be evasive with her questions. She would change. She didn't hear any gunshots, and she said she did hear some gunshots.
I don't remember, but I didn't see him shoot anybody.
But she was putting it all on Michael.
Nearly 24 hours after the murders, police apprehended Michael Claggett, who was drunk and sleeping in some bushes near his apartment. Detective Paul Yoakum interrogated Claggett.
I told him a lie. I told him that that the owner of the bar put little pin cameras up in the ceiling, and it's going to show him robbing and killing those people.
There were no cameras. All of that was a big, fat lie. But Michael Claggett fell for it and knew they would see him in the bar if this was true.
He gave me a full confession. He broke down, was crying, bawling.
I did it.
When he broke down and was telling me what he had done, he was extremely remorseful for what he had done. In fact, he said that he would like to be fried right now.
Though Michael admitted to being the shooter and begged to be given the death penalty, he claimed it was all Denise's idea.
They were at his townhouse, and they were having sex on the couch. And right after that, she was hinting to him that it was Navy payday. There could be some money at the Witch Duck Inn, and they could sure use some money. And if they pulled this off, they could be the next Bonnie and Clyde. And those were her words.
It's real. Just enough. Do it. We can do this. We can get away with it.
Michael told police he hesitated outside the Witch Duck Inn, having second thoughts.
She came out to him and said, "What? I've already told you, you know, there's only four people in there." She kept pushing him to come in and do it.
Once inside the bar, Michael claimed he again hesitated.
But he said every time he looked over to Denise Holsinger, she kept mouthing the words to him, "Do it. Do it."
He said, "Do it. I wouldn't let him live. I didn't get robbed, she's better murdered."
Denise insists she was not the mastermind that Claggett made her out to be.
I don't even know if Michael remembered things wrong. I think Michael just wanted to twist things to make me look worse than I was. It was not my ideal to rob the bar. Michael claimed that he had had a dream about it.
Michael Claggett did not have the capacity to be a mastermind in this crime. Michael Claggett was led by Denise.
At that time in my life, I don't think I was emotionally capable of masterminding anything.
And I didn't want to do it, and she kept saying, "Do it, do it."
I didn't know that anybody was even dead or anything until the next morning.
Michael was very in control of the situation.
Well, between Michael Claggett and Denise Holsinger, it's without a doubt that Denise Holsinger was the spider woman behind it.
Michael Claggett was largely witless. Denise Holsinger, to Michael Claggett, was a stronger drug than anything he'd ever tried before.
I had spent almost about 15 years in homicide total as a supervisor and interviewed a lot of individuals who had killed a lot of people in despicable manners. But in that interview room with Denise, there was some other presence in there. It was almost a presence of evil. I can't describe it to you. I've never felt it since.
The interrogations of Denise and Michael yielded more than enough evidence to put the two killers away.
This is a case of phenomenal police work, and this was nothing other than instincts, shoe leather, hunches, and talent when it comes to interviewing the people involved.
Virginia's law in 1995 protected Denise from the possibility of the death penalty because she did not pull the trigger.
It's extremely hard for the victim's family to be able to accept that fact.
She didn't pull the trigger, but she do all the killing, all the masterminding.
I believe Denise should be in the ground. She should have been executed just like Claggett was.
Before Michael Claggett get executed, his request was to speak to me, to ask me for forgiveness.
I know I'm gonna die for it. I want to. I don't want a lawyer, I just want to die.
His last words before he was put to death in the electric chair were that he was sorry. Virginia allowed inmates the choice of lethal injection or the electric chair. Michael Claggett chose the electric chair, and I can't help but think that was his last act of punishing himself even further.
I feel Michael got the easy way out. I deal with it every single day. Fear, disgust, shame.
Denise is serving her time at the Fluvanna Correctional Center for Women and coming to terms with the fallout from her life choices.
My life has been a tragedy waiting to happen.
She volunteers for jobs that will help others, such as transcribing books into Braille for the blind. Denise has no contact with her three children or ex-husband, Randall.
I hope that someday they will want to talk to me.
I am grateful that she gave birth to me, but I'm not sure if I love her. As of right now, I don't want contact with her. I can't say 15, 20 years down the road.
Michelle Holsinger was 8 years old at the time of her mother's crime. She is now a college graduate and studying to be a nurse.
I do worry a lot that people do judge me for the actions of my mother. I had been told once that the sins of the mother are the sins of the children. Definitely not true, because I apologize to flies for killing them. that I'm a very passionate and compassionate person.
It's not a day that I don't wish I could change what happened. And not because I got caught. I'm sorry. I'm sorry.
Next up on Women Behind Bars, a young mother allegedly lures a man to his death.
He took the gun out, pointed at my head and said, "This is the only way out our marriage, so don't F up."
For more information about Women Behind Bars, go to www.wetv.com. In the late night hours of October 23, 2004, five gunshots pierced the darkness along a deserted highway in rural Southwest Virginia. A 911 call led police to the body of 18-year-old Al Roberts, dead in a small clearing.
What we found was victim first shot was to the chest area, one to the left side of the head, one to the right side of the head, and it was two in the back area.
Roberts was last seen alive getting into a suburban truck with three men and a 19-year-old woman named Vanessa Crawley.
It appeared to be a robbery gone wrong.
Police apprehended Vanessa, her husband Christopher Crawley, and a third suspect, LaVon Rick Williams. Christopher confessed to being the shooter, but authorities suspected he did not act alone.
She was an accomplice to the entire plan, which led to murder.
I didn't kill anybody. I didn't know anybody was going to get killed. I was just there.
There was no question that she played a role. The question was how much of a role.
Was Vanessa an innocent witness to her husband's murderous act? Or did she knowingly lure a young man to his death? Vanessa Crawley was born in rural Virginia in 1985, the middle daughter of Roy and Robbie Gale Johnson.
I grew up in Clarksville, Virginia. It's a small town. We probably got like two stoplights. My mom and dad separated when I was like two, so my dad pretty much raised me and my two sisters.
After ending the marriage, Vanessa's mom moved to Kentucky, where Vanessa and her sisters visited every summer. As she grew up, Vanessa was involved in her church.
Vanessa was the president of the junior choir.
It was a good foundation because I always had a good relationship with God.
At 13 years old, Vanessa learned that her mother contracted HIV, the virus that causes AIDS, from a boyfriend. Within a couple of years, her mom succumbed to the disease.
The day before she passed away, I went to the hospital by myself and stayed there with her all day. And that night, it was time for me to go. And she said she didn't want me to leave. And she reached her hand out to me and she said, "I love you. I'll see you tomorrow." And when we came back the next day, she was unresponsive, and she passed that night. So I was the last person she talked to.
Dealing with the emotional part of their mom being sick, I really don't think Vanessa had a outlet. She bottled up all the inner emotions.
Vanessa met Christopher Crawley when she was 17. Chris was 18.
We talked on the phone for about 3 or 4 months, and he ended up coming to my house one day while my dad wasn't there, and that's when I got pregnant.
I was furious. I was upset. I really didn't have no rational thinking going on at that time.
Jalen was born October 23rd, 2003. It was the happiest day of my life.
The 18-year-old embraced motherhood.
She was a very good mom. She always loved to give him a bath, and she played with him. She was a very, very good young mother.
Chris, the baby's father, joined the Army.
My purpose was joining the military was to take care of my family, and I considered us a family.
But the young couple's relationship was already plagued with problems.
He was an alcoholic. He drank on the regular, all day, every day.
I used to get in a lot of fights when I was younger because I always thought people was out to get me. I've been back and forth with mental health since I was 12, and I stopped treatment when I went to the military.
Against her father's advice, Vanessa married Chris in December of 2003.
I really feel that he had some kind of stronghold on her that actually pulled her away from her family and pulled her closer to him.
Vanessa and baby Jalen moved to Georgia, where Chris was stationed.
When I got down there, he started abusing me.
He's a very abusive person. I've seen him, like, when she was pregnant, I've seen him push her down to the floor.
I was always scared of him because he would hit me for no reason.
He beat her. She wanted to get out. And she told me one time it was like she couldn't.
The abuse pushed Vanessa to a breaking point. Borrowing a friend's gun, she says she was ready to kill Chris one night while he slept.
I was standing at the doorway when I pointed the gun up. That's when the neighbor started knocking on the door. I was gonna shoot him and come back to Virginia, but God saved him that day.
The couple agreed to live apart for a while. In September 2004, Vanessa moved back to Virginia and into the home of Chris's grandmother. But Chris came to visit often, and the two continued their rocky relationship. Both admit to cheating on their marriage, and the resulting fights turned violent.
He would choke me up, pull me out the car by my neck.
She loved me, but at the same time, she was afraid of me.
I was putting up with it just to keep my family together.
Her choices that she made, some were good, some were bad, but that was the worst mistake that she made, was being with him. He claimed that he was in a gang. It's all he talked about.
On Saturday, October 23rd, 2004, Chris Crawley drove up from his Army base to celebrate his son's first birthday. He brought along a friend, LaVon Rick Williams. He also brought a 9mm handgun he recently purchased. That night, after the birthday party, Vanessa says Chris threatened her with the gun.
I was sitting in the car talking to him, and he was like, "You know anybody I can get some money from?" I was like, "This dude named Greg Davis. He told me if I ever need anything, all I had to do was ask."
Vanessa claims Chris gave her an ultimatum.
And that's when he took the gun out, pointed at my head and said, "This is the only way out of our marriage, so don't F up."
After that, I said, "Let's go find Greg Davis."
And that's when I really knew that he was serious and that he would hurt me if I didn't do what he wanted me to do or told me to do.
Vanessa and Chris cruised the streets of Chase City looking for Greg Davis. Also in the car were two of Chris's friends, LaVon Rick Williams and Joseph Pickett, as well as Vanessa's one-year-old son.
They were looking for a particular drug dealer to rob. That particular drug dealer was not at home.
Vanessa claims that Chris then hatched a new plan.
He was like, "Okay, well, go find somebody else."
They went to the Tasty Freeze area of Chase City, where there was a group of men out there. Vanessa got out and asked to buy some marijuana.
I, like, faked. Like, I wanted some marijuana just so somebody would come with me.
That somebody was Al Roberts, also known by the nickname Black.
Al Roberts was 18 years old, thought he was being given a ride home with the intention of selling them some marijuana.
He got in the car with me on the passenger side because my husband was in the back.
Vanessa claims Chris ordered her to drive down Spanish Grove Road and stop along a deserted stretch.
My husband got out, Alondra got out behind them.
Joseph Pickett, along with Vanessa and her baby, stayed in the vehicle.
My husband had a blue bandana over his face, and LaVondra had a black one over his. And they told Black Al Roberts to get out, put his hands up, told him put everything he had on the hood.
Mr. Roberts put everything on the hood. He only had $1 and a cell phone. That's all I've got, man.
I knew he was scared because of the look on his face. Next thing I know, he holds his chest, and as soon as he do that, I bent my head down because I didn't want to see no more.
Crawley shot him in the chest. He spun around. He started falling.
And my husband had shot him like 5 times.
And the witness says that the last shot he heard was Mr. Crawley leaning down and one last shot.
When Women Behind Bars continues.
The prosecutor tried to say that I was cold-hearted.
She didn't have anything to do with her husband's actions. He killed that boy.
On a chilly October night, 18-year-old Al Roberts accepted a ride home from Vanessa Crawley and a car full of men. They drove him to a patch of woods off a secluded highway. Vanessa claims she watched in horror as her husband, Chris Crawley, and accomplice, LaVon Rick Williams, allegedly pulled the victim from the Suburban, robbed him, then shot him 5 times point blank.
I was like shocked. For one, because I never thought my husband would do that.
After the shooting, Vanessa drove to a nightclub and dropped off Joseph Pickett. Then the group went home. Chris and LaVon Rick went to sleep, but Vanessa says she couldn't.
I ran some bath water and I just sat in the tub for a couple hours.
Joseph Pickett immediately called 911 to report the murder he had just watched happen before his eyes.
Dispatch called me on October the 24th, approximately 5 o'clock in the morning. The murder occurred just a few miles outside of Chase City.
Vehicle made a loop into this field, pulled back around facing the woods, and victim was found lying in this general direction, face down. Victim was shot 5 times. We recovered 5 shell casings here at the scene.
Police rushed to apprehend the 3 suspects and took them to the Mecklenburg County Sheriff's Office for questioning.
While we were speaking to Chris and Vanessa, as well as LaVondrick, they changed their stories a few times.
Vanessa admits she lied to police in her first statements because she was scared and trying to protect her husband.
My first statement, I told them that I would tell them that I shot him before I told them they did.
But eventually, she decided to tell the truth.
She was terrified, and she was basically trying to tell them something so it would all be over with.
What she had told in the statement was that Chris instructed her to do this.
We discovered that she also helped lure Mr. Roberts into the vehicle, and she knew that a robbery was going to occur. Chris ultimately confessed to shooting Al Roberts.
All 3 defendants were held in separate jails pending trial.
There would be no holds barred in this prosecution. The prosecution wanted convictions of all 3 of these people.
Chris Crawley chose to forego a trial. He pled guilty and was sentenced to 60 years, but Vanessa and LaVon Rick would take their chances in court. John Greenbacker was the defense attorney for LaVon Rick Williams, who claimed he was outside of the vehicle vomiting at the time of the shooting.
They had been drinking a huge amount of alcohol, and all that booze was making him sick to his stomach, and while he was there, he vomited. Next thing you know, he hears all this shooting going on towards the front of the car.
During the walk around, I did not see any evidence of any vomit. Now granted, it was raining.
At LaVon Rick Williams' trial, Chris Crawley backed up Williams' version of events.
Presence at the scene of a crime does not make you an accessory.
But Vanessa maintains it was a lie.
The truth is that he got out right behind my husband and was standing right beside him when he robbed him. He never went to the back of the truck.
The jury believed Williams and acquitted him of first-degree murder charges. Now it was Vanessa's turn to face the jury. It had been 2.5 years since the crime, and Vanessa's father believed she was already convicted by the local press.
When the newspaper was printed from week to week, they were saying that she was guilty. So how you gonna find a fair jury within a 200-mile radius?
The prosecutor tried to say that I was cold-hearted because I didn't cry.
When Vanessa was explaining her side of the story, she was hard to believe. I didn't see the remorse.
They might have felt like I didn't have no remorse, but I think it's because it took so long for them to try me, so when the time comes for me to go to court, it's like I can't cry.
Chris Crawley took the stand.
Chris admitted that he pulled the trigger. I think he was trying to take the blame away from Vanessa at this point.
Vanessa didn't know I was going to kill him because I didn't know I was going to kill him.
The fact that she didn't pull the trigger doesn't mean that she didn't lure Al Roberts to the car, that she didn't know their robbery was going to occur.
The law says if you knowingly participate in a robbery and there is a fire arm involved. And if it leads to murder, then you're an accomplice to the murder.
She had made statements implicating herself. I believe that her goose was cooked.
I don't think I got a fair trial.
She had no one call on that stand in her behalf. They would have been able to give key information about how Chris actually dominated her, abused her. Key people that could have spoke up on her character.
I felt like I was about to pass out. I couldn't believe that they had found me guilty.
Virginia is pretty much a law and order state. I don't think that people are very forgiving about crime, especially violent crime.
The guilty verdict hit Vanessa's family hard.
I still, right to this day, know deep down in my heart that she didn't have anything to do with her husband's actions. He killed that boy. And they still convicted her of 33 years in prison for something that her husband did.
She was protecting herself and her son that night. He put a gun to her head. How can you say no to somebody who does that? And your child is in the car. This is not fair at all.
For somebody to be as young as she was, a first-time offender. It shouldn't just been the hammer dropped on her.
33 years for Vanessa is a lifetime. There was no need for this crime to have happened.
Victim was only 18 years old. Mr. Roberts only had a $1 bill and a cell phone. He was shot for nothing, killed for nothing.
Chris basically ruined my sister's life, and he ruined part of mine too, because I can't sit here out anywhere and have a conversation with my sister.
Nothing's going to take the place of Al Roberts. But the victim, you know, the victim's family has closure that the perpetrator has done this is in jail.
Vanessa was sent to Fluvanna Correctional Center for Women and is still haunted by what happened that October night in 2004.
Literally weeks after that happened, I didn't even want to go to sleep because every time I closed my eyes, all I could see was out falling. It hurts. It still hurts today. I think about Al a lot because I know he got sisters and two brothers, and I think about them too, and they're lost.
Vanessa and Chris's son Jalen is now 5 years old and lives with Vanessa's father.
It was hard not being around him when you're used to him being there with you all day, every day.
Me and my wife, we keep him to church. And we raised him up with some morals and some values to be a different and a better man than what his father is.
I just hope that he'll be successful in his life.
Vanessa tries hard to stay connected to family.
Being away from my family, that's hard. That's all I ever knew.
She is still married to Chris, and they write to each other while incarcerated.
We just thought about communicating, because I really wasn't talking to him, but now he wants to stay with me, work it out, and be a family.
Vanessa harbors regrets, but holds out hope that she can come home soon.
I regret letting him have mind control over me. I regret driving that night. I'm gonna fight and keep fighting until somebody hears my side of the story.